Welcome to The Art of Healing. I'm your host and therapist friend, Trevor Hansen. On today's episode, we're talking about trauma. We've heard this word be thrown around on social media and in a lot of mental health kind of contexts. We hear this word, but what does it actually mean from a neurological standpoint? What's happening in the brain? This is one of the questions that we answer today, as well as how do we heal from trauma? Or what's one of, because there's many different ways to heal from trauma, what's one of the ways to heal from those traumas? And we kind of tie this all back to how does trauma show up in your relationships, and really what can you do about it? And I've got the perfect person to talk with about this, and it's Dana Koretestein. And Dana is known on Instagram as the EMDR coach, and her method of treating trauma is the most research-backed method out there, which is EMDR. If you don't know what it is, you will by the end of today. If you're interested in reaching out to her, or if you'd like to learn more about my therapy services, or you'd like to be on the pre-registry list, which what that means is that when my online course comes out, the Connected Couples course, you'll be receiving early access and at a discount. So if you want to be on that list, or you'd like to reach out to me about my therapy services or other things like that, please find my link in the description or in the show notes of this video or podcast, wherever you're watching or listening. Also, just a quick reminder, this podcast is not therapy, nor does it substitute for therapy. Thank you so much for joining me on The Art of Healing. Let's jump in. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing wonderful. The full moon is over, feeling a lot better.
The full moon is over.
Yes. It was like a full moon 2 nights ago. And I was like, that's why I was being horrible to my husband. Okay.
You know, that's something I haven't looked a lot into. Do you follow the lunar cycles? And
I just happened to notice, I looked out the window and saw it was a full moon and was like, oh, like I'm of the mentality. I'm like, if the moon can pull the tide, it could probably do. We're made up of like, what is it? Like 80% water or something.
That's true. Yeah. I could probably mess with us. It's like full moon's out. I'm turning into a werewolf. And treating everybody like garbage. You know, it's interesting. You would think that on a full moon, there'd be less crime because it's just bright outside and you're more likely to get caught. However, I was talking with my dad, who knows a lot of police officers in his work, and they were having a conversation. They're like, yeah, dude, full moons, it's just like crazy town. Like everybody comes out, they start just messing with stuff,
like women too. Like everyone's like, women tend to go into labor more when it's like a full moon. It's like the weirdest thing.
That's hilarious.
The weirdest thing. That's, and then the crazy scientist in me, of course, is like, well, like, you know, I was being a bitch to my husband. I'm like, really? My nervous system was just activated, and like it was probably that. But then I'm like, but maybe it's the full moon.
yeah. It's funny. You can either, like, when it comes to like moons and other things like that, I feel like you can either fall into like one of two camps. Like, oh, like scientific, like reasoning, like understanding, like maybe light exposure, or like I don't know, like gravitational pull. And then there's like the woo woo, like crystals and full moons and all that kind of stuff. So either way, maybe there's something to it.
You never know. Like, I feel like science is just catching up with some things that people have known for hundreds of years.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of science, I'm incredibly stoked to talk about EMDR today. That is like your wheelhouse. That is what you do.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of science behind that.
Yes.
Yes. So just for those who don't know who you are, who are listening, which is probably the majority of my audience, well, we probably have some overlap, I'd guess. But tell us a little bit about yourself. And that's a pretty broad question. But yeah, tell us a little bit about
like
yourself.
Like long walks in the park. No, like,
yeah. I love the full moon.
Love the full moon. I hate it, actually. Yeah. my name is Dana Koretestein. I am an EMDR certified therapist and EMDRIA approved consultant, basically meaning I have advanced level training in EMDR therapy. And I consult with other therapists who are either newly trained or recently trained and want to kind of enhance their skills more and work with clients as well. EMDR is a trauma-informed psychotherapy, a mind-body approach. So it's trauma-informed. That's what I love. We look at whenever a a client has symptoms. It's not what happened to them. I'm sorry, it's not what's wrong with them. It's what happened to them. And EMDR is great for that.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. The idea of, you know, what happened to you, I think has been a big play in my world as a therapist, as I have looked at things like, you know, things like borderline personality disorder in the past, for example. People have just kind of chalked it up as like, I don't know what they've chalked it up. Just as a label. But like, have you, as you understand it from like an attachment lens and how attachment is actually really formed based on, you know, either explicit trauma or like little micro traumas or what have you, it's just understanding like, okay, this all kind of comes from somewhere. Doesn't mean like we get a free pass for, you know, acting poorly or like hurting people or whatever.
Exactly. It's not like a get out of jail free card, but it's a more compassionate way to conceptualize mental health.
I think that's the word, is compassionate. Just like understanding like, oh, okay, this is where I'm coming from. This is what's happened to me. And now I can do something about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's how EMDR works, is it's linking into what we call, it's based on adaptive information processing. And that's fancy talk for like the adaptive info, like, oh, that makes sense. Like when someone really starts to understand why they might behave the way that they are and link it to those life experiences, and then tap into their body and the energy that has been released. That's how all of that works.
Yeah. And for those who are listening who haven't heard of EMDR and haven't like understood this, it might sound a little crazy right now, like tapping into the body and the energy and like all this, but help us understand a little bit about what is EMDR?
Yeah.
Where does it come from? What are we even talking about today?
Yeah, it stands for eye movement desensitization. It's so many vowels, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing.
Wow.
And it's an 8-phase structured treatment. And I say structured, you know, in air quotes, because it's also flexible, as well as there is a foundation for like a roadmap for how to set up your treatment plan. But it's the number one most effective evidence-based treatment for PTSD. And the World Health Organization recommends it for PTSD. And now, since EMDR was first discovered in, I think it was the 80s when Francine Shapiro discovered it, since then, they're also seeing how helpful it also is for anxiety, depression, because of that trauma-informed lens of, you know, it's what happened to us, the experiences that maybe we didn't even get, like not having a nurturing caregiver, things like that, which can lead to symptoms like depression as anxiety, rather than anxiety being a diagnosis.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It becomes not necessarily your problem, but your solution to your problem is the anxiety. Like, oh, I have to overcope or what have you in order to deal with what's actually going on underneath the surface.
Right. Exactly.
So when we talk about PTSD, I feel like understanding it from a neurological standpoint will really help us understand how EMDR is helpful. I think those two worlds and tying them is really helpful.
Absolutely.
And the term trauma gets thrown around a whole lot these days, you know? And it's like, what does trauma actually mean from a biological, neurological standpoint? Can you help us understand that a little more?
Absolutely. Because there's, I think, a lot of conversations out there of like, you know, some people are like, stop calling everything trauma. And some people are like, no, we need to talk about it more.
Right.
So PTSD, when we look at it that way, is a diagnosis. So in order for someone to, according to the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical, whatever, blah, 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 manual, people have to meet individual set of criteria in order to have that diagnosis.
Right.
So to have a diagnosis of PTSD, you have to meet that. To have experienced trauma, no one can tell you what's traumatic or what's not.
Right.
Trauma is not objective. Trauma is anything that your nervous system perceives as a threat. So for some people, everyone has different nervous systems. We're not all wired exactly the same way. So something might be traumatic to one person, but not to another. So maybe that, you know, one person might, in terms of diagnosis, fit the criteria. That's why I hate diagnosing people, because it's not, I don't like to label people with disorders when it's really just symptoms.
Right.
But as someone may have, fit more the criteria for generalized anxiety disorder versus textbook PTSD.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of like the difference between the two. And neurologically, when we look at PTSD, it's a brain injury. It's a neurological condition where when we do experience traumatic events, they have done functional MRI scans to show what's different in like first responders, for example, what their brains look like before EMDR treatment and what they look like after. And before, there's overactivation in the amygdala, in the limbic system. Yeah. The prefrontal cortex is more offline versus after treatment. They show more activity in the hippocampus, meaning things have been actually encoded into long-term memory.
Yeah.
Instead of being overactivated in the limbic system.
Yeah. And this is an important element because as we conceptualize the brain and kind of different roles of different parts, that limbic system is that fight flight, you know, it's that emotional brain. And then the frontal part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, the frontal cortex, things like that. That's where we get like logic and reasoning and we're like making sense of things. And so as I've explained it, when we're talking about trauma with individuals, I say there's kind of like this version of you in the past that is kind of stuck there and it always, and it's like living in the present, thinking that whatever has happened to me in the past is happening to me today, right now. And that part of you lives in your limbic brain. It doesn't live in the frontal cortex because right here, I know that like life is good. It's not the same. It's okay. But that part of you is kind of stuck there in that spot.
Exactly. That's why we say PTSD is a lack of time orientation. Like you said, it is so well said, but there's a part, that traumatized part is living in trauma time. Mm-hmm. So anytime there's, you know, a loud sound or something, like if it's, you know, someone who was an army veteran or something like that and using more textbook PTSD, but you know, not, you don't have to have like been in a war to have PTSD.
No.
But like hearing that loud sound or something like that triggers that part that's stuck in trauma time.
Yeah.
And then that part impedes on your present day self and impacts your present day self's ability to function.
Yeah, it's true. You don't have to be in war or like have gone through a terrible car accident or whatever to have these kinds of symptoms. We think about kind of, as I was mentioning earlier, a lot of my audience follows because they're working on like understanding their own selves in order to show up better in their relationships. And I think a big part of that is when, you know, people have grasped onto the idea of attachment and the styles of attachment. And really, it comes down to kind of those trauma parts of us in a way, like, I had a parent who is incredibly distant and not very close and not very loving. And that's traumatic to a child for sure, especially pre-language. Like they don't know what's going
pre-verbal,
on.
Pre-verbal. Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And
as
so that,
babies, we don't have the ability to make sense of what's happening because we don't have the life experience yet.
No. And so it's interesting. We say like, okay, now we try to cope because it starts to feel like that's our reality. You know, the person who's close to me, the person I need is distant. And that could be just like, oh, they don't text you back for a few hours, or like they're on vacation and we don't get to talk every day. And instead of just like, oh, okay, they don't text me back or they're on vacation, it becomes I'm at risk. Yeah, I'm at risk of losing everything. And really, it's interesting to think of attachment through the lens of trauma, but I really think it is.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's, I think, what we probably have both seen as therapists, and I know you do a lot of relationship work, is that relational trauma is so common. We don't talk about it enough, but attachment trauma is so real. And it's, you know, what I explain a lot to clients is, you know, imagine a baby, right? Like we always say developmental is like 3 years or younger. So imagine like, you know, a one-year-old or even like an infant, even younger, laying in a crib and crying. If that infant isn't responded to in a consistent way, it doesn't have to be all the time. As parents, we're not perfect, but an infant is completely helpless and unable to take care of themselves. So that feeling of I'm going to die is so real. As infants, we will die without a caregiver.
For sure.
So then that, if that happens to us in childhood, that shows up in relationships because neurons that fire together wire together.
Oh yeah.
Right? So that association was made that someone that's close to me is paired with that feeling of I'm going to die.
Yeah.
So anytime it's a close relationship, an interpersonal relationship, those old feelings and thoughts come back.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of cool because we're talking about something that's, you're talking about, you know, neurons wiring together. And so therefore it doesn't have to be conscious memory even in order to have these pathways built. Cause some people are like, yeah, like I can't think of anything that would like, you know, make me feel this way. And oftentimes the things that are going to make you feel this
they're
way,
they're not
going to
remember.
They're not going to remember them. Your brain like physically remembers them because it's built itself around those memories. So you're really not going to remember them consciously.
It's not going to be a visual memory.
No.
But your body remembers.
Totally. Exactly.
Your body remembers.
Yes. I love that. So
that's why I love, there's a specific protocol we do with EMDR. It's very different from the standard protocol. It was founded by Katie O'Shea and Sandra Paulson called the Early Trauma Protocol. And it's very different from the standard, but it's wildly successful and helpful because it doesn't have somebody try to identify visual memories. It's working more with the felt sense in the body.
Interesting. So how does that look? Like, what does the process kind of look like if somebody's sitting there doing that early trauma protocol? What would they expect to experience in therapy?
So there's a lot of assessment that goes on in the beginning before, because individuals with early trauma, developmental trauma, there's usually a lot of dissociation. Not everybody, but we tend to see that a lot, and a lot of disconnect from our body. So clients who've experienced developmental trauma may often report feeling numb, can't feel sensations in their body, things like that. So a lot of assessments in the beginning of just assessing for safety. So before we even do that processing work, let's make sure you feel safe enough to do so. Because even for individuals, like even the therapist cannot feel like a safe person. Because it's anybody that's close. So there's a lot of rapport building, all of that assessing in the beginning. And then how it works is instead of processing memories or experiences, we target timeframes. So we start with, there's like a whole sequence that you go in, and it's a little different again in the way that the standard protocol is done, is where we usually have the client lay down as long as it feels comfortable for them to do so, because it's a little easier to notice the sensations in your body when we do that.
Yeah.
And then we go by time frame, and we'll say, let's notice, let's go to the time like before you were even born. And before this process, we'll have done history taking as well to just see if there was anything that they were aware of, like stories they've heard, things like that.
Yeah.
And then as you focus on that time period, just scan your body head to toe, notice what you feel in your body, and go with that. And we're letting the body tell the story of what, you know, what that felt like. So it works great for generational trauma too.
Yeah.
And then we go to conception. Then we do target trimesters, where it's usually the first trimester, second, third, the actual birth, which is very, very helpful for any individuals who there was a birth trauma, like cord wrapped around their neck, something like that.
Yeah.
And then first 3 years of life works great for individuals with who've been adopted, things like that, because there were ruptures in attachment. So it's letting the body tell the story of that child, of whether they were still in utero, any of that. Like it lets that baby tell their story of what it felt like for them in that moment in time.
Interesting.
And we're releasing that and then offering repairs. So instead of, you know, with standard protocol, we're trying to just like reprocess and desensitize something. In this approach, we're also trying to invite in an experience that they might not have had. So imagine what you needed back then. Can you imagine that baby getting that now? Notice what that would feel like right now and go with that.
Gotcha.
So it's helping reprocess, release, and repair.
Yes.
All those attachment wounds.
That's a beautiful concept. I love that. I love the idea of kind of tuning into the body rather than visual conscious memory, because yeah, a lot of these things can't be accessed through memory.
Yeah, and clients get so frustrated. They're like, I can't remember anything. That's okay.
It's all good.
It's all
No
good.
worries.
You don't need to remember stuff. Your body will tell us.
Wow, that's cool. So, when we're talking about EMDR, what maybe there's two questions. We'll kind of get to them. Is that what does it actually look like for someone who hasn't done it? Because a lot of people are listening here because they're focused on building better relationships and they want to work on their own personal stuff, looking for resources, things like that. So, like, what does it look like when I actually do EMDR, and how does it help us to get unstuck? How does it help these memories, these experiences, to our brain start functioning more in the prefrontal cortex, in the hippocampus, start living in the present? How does it even work?
Yeah, so especially for individuals who relationships are the trigger, it will, how EMDR works is whenever you meet with a person with an EMDR therapist, I tell my staff too, we have a group practice here that, someone, they want EMDR therapy. That doesn't mean that it's going to be the perfect fit for them or whatever. So I always say it takes at least 1 to 3 sessions to get what my trainer once said is to get a lay of the land, get the clinical landscape, and then determine if EMDR is a good fit or determining if maybe a different protocol will help or so forth. And to also be able to dictate the treatment plan. And with individuals who want to improve their relationships, it's going to be more than likely going to those attachment wounds where there might have been ruptures in attachment. For some individuals, maybe it was a more a present day thing where they were married to like a narcissist or something, which can definitely impact someone's ability to form close relationships with others afterwards. So with those things that are more quote unquote recent, we actually target specific memories. And for a lot of people with complex trauma, and relational trauma is complex trauma because it's not like one isolated event of like there was
Right,
this
it's a
one time.
series.
It's a series. So we will usually say like let's target like the first one, the worst one, the most recent. That's kind of like the standard approach. Because all we're doing in that sense is we're trying to find a doorway into the nervous system to then say the, as my Apple Watch starts yelling at me, sorry.
It's
We're
okay.
trying to find a doorway into the nervous system. And with EMDR, we want to see like which of those experiences will help us get into those neural networks where like the trauma is stored. Figure out all those out. That's in history taking. We kind of do that targeting of memories. We don't go into the details. We just identify which ones we want to work on. And then phase two, the resourcing stabilization is so important. Most people think EMDR is just phase four. Like, when are we going to get to like the processing the trauma? Like, when are we going to do EMDR? I'm like, you're doing it. Processing is only one part of the 8 phases. So resourcing is something that is so important, and a lot of individuals want to skip over it because they think that the trauma processing is the most important, and it's the resourcing is what's most important, in my opinion. Other people might say otherwise. But those phase two, what you learn in that phase of EMDR is how to feel safe in your body and how to regulate your nervous system so that when we process certain memories, you don't shut down or fly into a panic attack. So that's super important. And then when we process those memories and we do get to the experiences that we've identified, we target them on, we break down a memory and experience in 3 different ways. We target like there's 7 magic questions we call them. So it's when we think of, that fight you had with your ex-husband, what's an image that represents the worst part? And I'll say to clients sometimes, if it were like you were watching a movie and you paused on the worst part of that experience, what image would be on the screen? And as you bring all your attention to that image, what words do you believe about yourself right now? Whether it's like, I'm not safe, I'm trapped. And so then we're getting into the neocortex, that first level of the brain,
Right.
with those cognitions. What do you wish you could believe right now, even if you don't believe it? So we're tickling the brain to try to eventually link to adaptive networks, like feel good stuff.
Yeah.
How true do those words feel to you? 1 to 7. 7 is totally true. 1 is totally false. So we get some rating scales in there so we can assess how the functioning is going. Now, when you bring all your attention to that image on the screen and those words, I'm not safe, what emotions do you feel right now? Anger. So we're getting into that limbic system. So we're dropping down. Like in terms of the brain, it's the target assessment is neocortex, limbic system, brainstem. So what emotions do you feel right now? 0 to 10. 10 is the highest disturbance you can imagine. 0 is no disturbance at all. How disturbing is this experience for you right now? And then scan your body head to toe. Where do you feel that disturbance in your body? So that's getting to that deepest part of the brain.
Yeah.
Because we're dropping in, because the brain processes information in our day-to-day experiences. The brain processes from the bottom up. So if something gets jammed or stuck because it didn't get encoded into the hippocampus, it's still in there. So we drop down to get to that, like kind of like easily lowering somebody into where there's distress. And then we say, okay, so notice all that, the image, the belief system, emotion, body sensation, and follow. And we'll either do eye movements left and right, or tactile buzzing left and right. Some people do audio and headphones, but bilateral stimulation. So you're alternating activations of the left and right hemispheres of your brain. And when you do that, you're lighting up the whole brain. So you're, the theory behind it is that your whole brain can activate and try to process what got stuck.
Yeah.
So lighting that all up. So it's top to bottom, left and right. And so we'll do a set. And we'll say, just notice that, follow, and then take a pause. What did you notice? And the check-ins in between the sets of bilateral are supposed to be brief. They're not, the goal is to not get into a conversation.
Yeah.
Because that can actually take us out of processing mode. So when we talk, that's more neocortex cognitive functioning. So we don't want to do that. So it's just, what do you notice? So people say like my chest is getting tight. Notice that. Now, what do you notice? Like, now I'm like, this worst part of the memory is like when he threw something at me, go with that. And as we go through sets, what the brain does is it's like it's a puzzle piece and it starts putting the pieces of the puzzle together. So you might spontaneously remember something else that you've forgotten about, or something positive that disproves or kind of cancels out the distress related to the negative experience, like a time where you felt empowered. And all of that helps that experience move and get encoded into long-term memory, so it no longer lives in its real, like real-time raw state as if it just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting talking about what you're saying that I'm hearing that is, I think is important, is that the reason a lot of these, you know, traumatic responses, are there's some logic here to say that like the brain processes things, you know, kind of from the bottom up, which is like that sensory information first. It's like, okay, just bringing in info. What do I feel in my body? What do I see, smell? And so that's why a lot of those sensory triggers are so important to understand, is because that's how it like starts, and then it gets stuck in that space where it's like, okay, sensory trigger, and now limbic system live, you know, I'm living it. It's not a memory. It's like live experience.
It's happening right now. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But I usually tell people, like, I love analogies. I think it's helpful to understand things. So the way I describe it to people sometimes is, imagine you're like emptying your dishwasher and you're putting things away. So you're trying to like sort the utensils. When you pull out a fork, you use your somatosensory information first because you look at it. Vision is one of your 5 senses. And then you determine with your like neocortex where that goes. Yes. And that's how the brain processes information, whether it's through sight, through smell, through touch, and then we decide what to do with that information.
Yes.
but we get traumatized because something happens and we don't have any frame of reference to like make sense of it. So we're like, I don't know where this goes. I don't know where this utensil goes. So I'm just going to leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with traumatic memories. They get jammed. They get stuck because we don't have anything to link it to. Anything of like, oh, that makes sense. This goes here. So yeah. We can't say like, oh, that's why that happened. Because my husband's a narcissist. Like, that's why I was getting, instead of what we usually do is we can't match it anywhere. And we go, oh, I must have been a bad person. I must not be good enough.
Hmm.
And then the memory stays in that raw state with that negative belief system, which causes, you know, depression, anxiety, all of that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting how, you know, trauma, I think as it's presented oftentimes is maybe a little bit oversimplified in the sense that it's stimulus to, just like a fight, flight, freeze response. However, I think what you're saying there is the tie between the stimulus and also belief construction that also happens.
Right.
And that's huge because a lot of those beliefs are the things that then show up in your relationships and create disconnection and create conflict and all sorts of things. Because if a person's constantly believing that they're not good enough or worthy, but yet they have this fearful longing to be worthy and good enough, that's going to come with some pretty maladaptive coping mechanisms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely can. It, because our nervous system gets so activated, our nervous system, like story follows state, right? So the story we tell ourselves follows the state of our nervous system.
Hmm.
What can also happen just neurologically is, let's say like something happens and then we have nowhere to match it to. That's when, so we tell ourselves a story. That's one way. Or sometimes something happens and it's so intense that our neocortex goes completely offline. So we can't do anything to store it. It's because like that part of our brain is just not functioning because our nervous system got so overactivated. And how it works is that we say like with learning, there's an optimal level of arousal that needs mm-hmm. to happen for learning to take place.
Yeah.
So when that happens, it's that, you know, good, like quote, eustress, there's good stress.
Right.
So it activates the limbic system and the hippocampus so they both can stay online. And then the amygdala assists in encoding that into long-term memory in the hippocampus. Mm. When somebody gets very, like it's very, very stressful, cortisol actually shuts down the way that the hippocampus primarily functions. So if there's too much stress, the hippocampus shuts off, the amygdala is still activated, but right. It's got nowhere to put it.
Mm.
It's got nowhere to go.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So it's like our filing cabinet gets locked and mm-hmm. all of this information is coming in and it's like, shoot, what are we going to do now?
Yep. And when we say like when the neurocircuits can't flow, trauma piles up.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense. So for a person who's looking to try EMDR, how do they know, like, is this a right fit for me? Like, what are some of the questions that people start asking themselves when they start hearing about EMDR that you find most common?
Yeah, that's a great question. Usually people will say, like, how do I know it's the right fit for me?
Yeah.
And we'll say, like, well, we don't know. That's why we have consultations. Like, schedule free consults with a therapist to kind of get an understanding of what your symptoms are, because EMDR links past to present. So a lot of times people will call and say, they might say something like, oh, like this happened to me. And I'll say, okay, so what are your present day symptoms? Because just because something terrible happened to us doesn't mean that we have to be affected by it.
Right.
So I want to know what the symptoms are. What are you struggling with present day? Like, constantly fighting with your partner, or you can't connect to another person but you want to.
Yeah.
And then we say, okay, now let's take that present day symptom and link it to the past experiences where it was first became a thing.
Yeah.
Do you feel like people will usually ask that?
Yeah. That's helpful because you're saying like, okay, yeah, just because you've experienced something really terrible and could potentially be, you know, traumatic on its face, like as we listen to it, it's like, oh, that should definitely be traumatic. And maybe it's not for some people. Is there any, I don't know any, is there any, I guess, evidence or understanding of the susceptibility to trauma amongst people? Like, what makes a difference? Like, who's more easily traumatized and who's not?
Adverse childhood experiences study. That will show, like, there is a statistic. I forget what the actual number is, but it's high. It's somewhere in the 90s that individuals who have attachment trauma, like adverse or have experienced multiple adverse childhood experiences, are much more likely to develop like diagnosable textbook PTSD from a more present day experience.
Is that because
that's also your brain is just set up already to be something you get jammed?
Yeah. Okay. And that was kind of part of my question too, is that because I could almost see it coming from two sides. It's like, okay, because of those adverse childhood experiences, maybe you're living in a certain way, trying to cope with that, that creates more opportunities for trauma. Like, if I have adverse childhood experiences, I have childhood trauma, most likely I'm going to have some maladaptive coping mechanisms within relationships. I might find people, you know, who are similar to my parents and recreate my trauma. And so therefore I'm more likely... I'm more likely to get traumatized there. And then on the other side is there, like the actual neurological side of things. Like, oh, my brain is just a little bit more susceptible to it. So, or maybe it's just a combination of both. It's like, you're probably going to put yourself in situations where you're going to get traumatized more likely, and your brain is a little bit more susceptible to trauma. I don't know. Am I on the right path
here?
No, you're
spot on. You're spot on. We say experiences shape the brain. So being more susceptible to be traumatized by something does depend on our earliest life experiences. So individuals who have childhood trauma, nervous system wise, there's interoception and proprioception, all of these nervous system terms, but that basically dictates how we scan for danger, how we perceive our environment. Individuals with childhood trauma, it's almost like their alarm system, their threat detector, is malfunctioning.
Yeah.
Because let's say they had a dangerous caregiver. For them, I've had so many clients over the years when they describe like their childhood, and they're shocked to find out that it was traumatic because they thought it was normal. So they can't accurately assess for danger because that alarm system was like faulty almost.
Yeah.
Because what they thought was normal, so they assume that to be what's normal is safe. So they're much more likely to find, like in relationships, if a parent was like an alcoholic or something, we see this all the time, right? Like they wind up, you know, being attracted to individuals with addictive behaviors because there's a similarity in the blueprint. And they also, it feels normal. There doesn't feel like a threat.
Yeah.
It's comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's also from an attachment lens, this idea of trying to recreate something that wasn't given to you originally. If your parent was an alcoholic, they were also distant. You were seeking long connection and it didn't happen. Then, okay, there's a part of my brain that says, I'm going to find somebody as close to that as possible and see if I can get back what I missed out on. Can I find an alcoholic who also loves me, who also is close to me and connected? I feel like there's a part of our brain that like wants to fill in those holes.
Absolutely. That's the repair attempt. When we do that, we're seeking the repair. And that's where EMDR and the early trauma protocol or even the standard helps your brain to do that on its own. So then you can, it's like you, like the gift of like trauma therapy is you learn to give yourself what you never got.
Yeah.
So then you stop seeking it from other people. And then instead, and of course, like that comes with a caveat, like we are hardwired for connection. So of course we want to be able to get like care and love from a partner. But when you process those experiences from your past, then you're much more likely to identify a partner who can give you that. Instead of seeking that repair.
I love that idea. Yeah, I think the word repair fits really well because I've talked about this concept for a while in the lens of attachment as I'm an EFT therapist, emotionally focused.
I love
therapy.
EFT.
Yeah, and so obviously
it goes very well with EMDR.
Yes, totally. And I love the idea of them seeking repair. I think repair is a perfect word for that. Yeah, I'm
We're trying to
curious.
get what we never got.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how can I fill in this hole? Because I've got a hole. It bugs me, even if it's subconsciously. Like, it's gonna drive this longing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where EFT is so helpful. Actually, like my husband and I, we've been in therapy. Our couple's therapist was EFT.
Oh, really?
And my favorite, that's like where I had that moment when we were like in session. And anyone who knows me knows, like, I am the most, like, I'm a caretaker. I'm nurturing, I'm loving, like, I'm very Italian. I feed anybody who comes to my house. But in session, my husband had said, like, I don't understand why Dana can't just be like a loving wife. And I give him that, like, are you fucking kidding me? Me? And she just leaned in to him and goes, does that translate to loving mother? And I was like, Yahtzee, like, no more callers. We have a winner. And for me, it felt so validating because, like, it's like the crazy making almost of like, how am I not loving? I feel like I'm so loving. And for my husband, it was so helpful to understand how the past was impacting how he perceived the present. He didn't see me correctly. He was seeing me, like, because, like you said, the hole, we have a hole. He, like, wasn't able to, like we use the cup analogy. And he's like, I can't, Dana's not filling my cup. And our therapist is like, because your cup has a hole in it.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And like he was longing for you to fill a role that's not your role. No matter
And even
how.
though, and that's what, like, the repairs, like, I am so loving. And my husband, like, thank God for our therapist because things are beautiful with us now. I mean, we fight still, but who doesn't? But because of that, like, even though I'm so nurturing and loving, like, ideally, that would have been the repair he was looking for, but it still wasn't enough because he had like that, the trauma, the hole. And that's why, even still, like, yes, relationships can help us heal, but even if that's not helping, that's why trauma-informed practices help.
And it's interesting as we kind of draw out the analogy of, a hole in a cup is that that hole has a very specific size and shape, and no matter what, you are not that size and shape for that hole. It is, that history with an early caretaker, mother, father, whatever, or past partner, they're that shape. And it's like, no matter what I do, like I can't do that. And I think even without going through, trauma-informed or trauma-focused therapy, I think this is an opportunity for people listening to kind of step back and like, hold on, am I trying to have somebody fill a hole? Because even just that awareness, like you don't have access to therapy or, whatever the case might be. I think just that pure awareness and letting your body
Absolutely.
know, like, oh, I'm doing this. I'm trying to make you my mother when you're my wife.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I mean, you speak to a great point that, some individuals can't access therapy, which is so upsetting. And I'll save that soapbox for another time. But creating that awareness, like, for people who, especially who can't access that, is so helpful because if you can really, like, do the work and cultivate that curiosity of, I wonder why I do that, or I wonder why I feel this way. Sometimes it's, we feel this way because it's completely appropriate and valid and rational. But if you're noticing a pattern, it's helpful to go, like, huh, does my cup have a hole in it? Or am I trying to get a repair where I'm never going to get one? Like, what's happening here? What part am I playing into this dynamic? Not in a blaming way, but in a curious way.
Yeah, it's true. And what's so cool about that is that when you stop trying to repair that hole with the wrong repair, like your partner, thinking that they're the fix, you actually get to access your partner for like who they actually are. You actually get to like experience the person that you chose in a way that they're meant to be experienced. And I think that's a pretty beautiful thing.
Isn't it? Yeah, you get to appreciate someone's true, authentic self.
And I think you probably start to see yourself as a little bit more authentically understanding
Absolutely.
who you are. Well, Dana, on that note, I'm so grateful that we had the opportunity to talk. For those who are
Me
interested
too.
in reaching out and learning more about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can definitely check me out. On Instagram is the EMDR coach, the_EMDR_coach. They can check out my website, danacaretta.com, two R's, two T's. I also just recently wrote a book, the EMDR Therapy Progress Journal, which is for everyone. You don't have to be an EMDR to be able to do it. Mm. It's all about trauma-informed care, and it talks about all the things we just talked about today of how experiences shape our brain. There's all information on the nervous system, and it's designed to help cultivate curiosity and get people thinking about themselves a little differently, to shift from shame and blame to feel and heal. And that's available on my website as well. It's available on Amazon, so you can find me there.
Wonderful. Well, I will put, if those who are listening, in the show notes or in the description of the video, if you're on YouTube, I'll put links to Dana's her Instagram and to her website as well, so that you can find that there. But thank you so much again for joining me. It has been wonderful.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Art of Healing. Again, if you're interested in learning more about my therapy services, you'd like to contact me, or you'd like to be on the pre-registry list for the Connected Couples course, please find my link tree in the description of this video or in the show notes. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.